And now, let me welcome Minister Echeverri and Governor De Gregorio to the table here.
All right. Well, thank you. Now we come to the final panel of this session. I'm delighted to introduce the Governor of the Central Bank of Chile. He's a very good friend from many years, very distinguished colleague, José de Gregorio. José is now Governor of the Central Bank, was Deputy Governor of the Central Bank of Chile, was Minister of Energy in Chile during the administration of Ricardo Lagos, has been here in Washington several stints, both at the World Bank and the IMF, PhD in economics from MIT, and above everything, a very well-respected economist with many, many interesting contributions, some of which surfaced earlier on before you arrived on the effectiveness of capital controls. And I'm sure that in his presentation he'll enlighten us with his views on what's going on around this interesting debate and the policy issues of Latin America. So, Jose, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to welcome here to Brookings.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm sorry for being first. That was just a confusion. And it is a pleasure to be here. And I basically, let's go, I'll talk about four things. I'll first make a very brief introduction about Latin America. Then I'll talk about macroprudential. Just a note, when I wrote this macroprudential, it's the only word in the whole presentation that the dictionary of word didn't find. So it's so just to start. Then I'll make some comments about Dutch disease, and then I'll go to the core that everybody wants to hear, what the Chilean talks about, capital inflows, exchange rate appreciation, capital controls, and I said, well, said capital controls, whatever. Capital controls should be the last one. So just let me make you some comments about the macro performance of Latin America. Latin America had unprecedented performance. It used to be that when advanced economy had a flu, Latin America had a pneumonia. And what we saw in the crisis, that the world had pneumonia and Latin America got a flu. So this is, I think, quite important. Why, and this is a part that I went through the, I think that is in this report, I would have like a bit more of discussion of some of the topics, especially going on a country basis, because what are the reasons for this extremely successful historical performance? I have gone a long time to see data, and it's very difficult to find a period in which the world economy is falling and Latin America, on average, is falling about what the world is falling and recovering much faster. So first, good macro policies. Inflation is low. There is some form of fiscal prudence. We can discuss a lot about how to deal with on the macro basis, but at least from the levels of public debt, of fiscal reform in many countries. I mostly focus on LAC 7, as the paper said, so because it's there is a lot of heterogeneity. So fiscal prudence, much more independent central bank. You don't hear populists saying that inflation has no cost. Everybody knows that it's costly. So I'm talking this is for a wide variety of political inclinations. I think that there has been a severe improvement in macroeconomic policies. Second, financial systems are much more resilient. We have had so many financial crises that finally we have a relatively sound financial regulation, perhaps could be financial and the development. Okay, but in a way, we didn't went through the excesses that went into advanced economies. And that, of course, it makes recessions much more less damaging because the financial system stays sound. So here there is a discussion, and I think that thinking about the future, if ain't broken, why to fix it? Why we have a lot of discussion on what to do, the new macro policy, if what we've been doing in the last 10 years was relatively okay? And there is a third factor, which is, I say, is sort of the risk factor. It's good luck. We have had very good terms of trade, and unusually good terms of trade, historical high terms of trade. As it was said in the previous presentation, yeah, I tend to agree that we are going through a cycle I wouldn't say long term, but it's a relatively long cycle of good commodity prices. Perhaps not as high as today, but that does not imply that some adjustment may happen, especially if interest rates in the advanced economy start going up sharply. We will have a correction in terms of trade. So this is a risk. So if terms of trade are high and they decline sharply, what will happen to Latin America? So I like to think of this as conducting a stress test. We should have a stress test of Latin American economies. What's happened if, let's say, copper price go to a dollar? I think that's very little in the Chilean economy. I won't make propaganda. That's not the purpose of this discussion, but very little. But perhaps if soja or coffee, whatever, oil declining sharply, that could be extremely damaging. It could be a tail risk, a very small probability event, but I think that's where a big risk. Now, we have new risk also today, and I would have liked, I went through the paper, so I didn't come to the presentation, but I read it, and I would have liked more discussion about the resilience of Latin American economies to terms of trade shocks. I think that's a one big risk. And the other risk, this is a real risk. It's not a tail risk. It's overheating and inflation. And this, of course, may bring financial vulnerabilities. So let me go to my second point about macro. This is just a title. There are a couple of figures. So don't expect me to go through the tables and figures and figures. So macroprudential policies. As I told you, macroprudential still does not exist in regular dictionaries, at least for Microsoft, what they call regular dictionaries. They are extremely broadly defined, and they can be used to do whatever. So it sounds mainstream to say, I'm not doing control, I'm not doing fixing things, I'm doing macroprudential. That's kind of cool. So it fits everything. And we say we're very prudent, so we can do this new policy. But I want to, I have tried to, my own definition, which is very close to what the FAN and everybody said, the BIS said. So there are policies to avoid the building of financial vulnerabilities coming from the interaction between among financial institutions, among themselves, or with the macro environment. So this is macroprudential. What we don't want is the financial system to have systemic risk that can contaminate the whole economy. So in this regard, I like to the two dimensions that are used to distinguish macro policies. There are interactions among institutions in a point of time, and there are interactions of the financial system with economic environment over time. So the overtime dimension is the dynamic dimension, and this is all the discussion about procyclicality. So then there are discussions in the world, Basel III, and many regulations to avoid procyclicality of the banking system. At the point in time, there are the big story about the too big to fail. Okay? Too big to fail is a problem. There are institutions that are too big or too interconnected or too relevant in the financial system that since they won't fail, they can take more risk and they can generate a lot of a cost, as we have seen. Even small institutions, because of their role in the liquidity and in the means of payment, it can be very damaging, the problems with this institution. Of course, there is with the too big to fail, there is a serious moral hazard problem. Okay? So then, macroprudential, what has to do? Very clear rules for resolution. Okay? So also for shareholders paying the cost, leaving wills, there is a whole dimension. In terms of emerging markets, one can think that the use of reserves can be used in order to build insurance over time. There is also the insurance provided by the IMF, and there are some other insurance. I think that I said that they are not used because accumulation of reserves serve two purposes at one time, which is to insure yourself against sudden reversal of capital flows, and at the same time you intervene in the forex market. So that's what you do. And that's why countries do not go and get perhaps a cheaper insurance from the IMF, because they say, well, when I accumulate reserves, it's expensive, but I also provide some intervention in the forex market. And here they say, I'll you made a point. Well, this is not about what you said, but this is about this. I think that having reserves, they don't reduce the risk premium. But I think that they are a deterrent. The puzzle is the following. Countries have a lot of reserves, and they don't use them. And then you say, well, but why they have so much reserves? They don't use them, and they don't have problems of financing. During the peak of the crisis, just few countries, if you see the evolution of reserves in the worst crisis since the Great Depression, were hardly used. Some in Brazil, in Mexico, in Korea, because of some corporation problems to stabilize them, but very, very small. So why? So you say, well, we shouldn't have reserves. But at the end, reserves are a deterrent. Now, what's the problem of if all the world has a lot of reserves, then the optimal or the reasonable level of reserves become dependent on what the others are doing, because financial markets discriminate and they look at the sample. They say, well, at the population, they say which countries are more vulnerable. So if all they have a lot of reserves, you say, okay, let's have a lot. And this is a, so this is, but there are two other dimensions of macroprudential that I think that are more, we can discuss. One is a truly macroprudential, that we said we don't want to build vulnerability. And the other, which is here is where comes the discussion, it's not macroprudential, it's macro policy. But it's a complement to monetary and fiscal policy. Why? Because we don't want to do monetary policy that affects the exchange rate. So instead of raising rates, we put reserve requirement. That's very old-fashioned. That's in the old-fashioned books that say you can tighten monetary policy raising rates or increasing reserve requirements. So it's quite standard. It's a quite old-fashioned, I would say. I would call this non-conventional macro policies, but not to go and say macroprudential. I think that that's kind of a good abuse of the name. So let's talk more. Now, I agree that there is a fine line to divide this, because one policies may help, for example, accumulation of reserves for exchange rates and at the same time for macroprudential reasons. Okay? But there are also instruments that you can look at if your worry is about some potential financial vulnerabilities. Many times there are macroprudential rules, policies that not necessarily becomes to these broad issues of capital controls or whatever it is. If we are worried about currency mismatches, the first and the best, and by the way, Latin America had a huge, if you see, if you see the evolution of exchange rates during the crisis, there were depreciation 20-30%, and no financial problem because currency mismatches were not a problem in Latin America and all emerging markets. But why? Because there is a macroprudential rules that limit currency mismatches to the amount of capital, and then you have tons of rules. Then if your problem is because we're taking too short or because we're borrowing too short and there is a maturity mismatch, which is a maturity transformation is part of the banking system, but if there is too much maturity mismatch, we can do levies, we can do provisions, we can do surcharge, and going straight to the balance sheet of banks without saying that there are other things. The other thing, that this is one, it reminds me of something that I discussed in 09 about still no figures. Something that I said in a couple of years ago here at Brookings. There is one problem of financial vulnerability in emerging markets that is complicated, and it's bubbles in emerging markets. Why? Because there was a huge discussion about how we fight bubbles in advanced economies. If you have a housing bubble, you say, let's go up with the interest rate, let's tighten, and perhaps, this may have effects. But what are the kind of bubbles that we have seen in emerging markets? The kind of bubbles that we see in emerging markets are bubbles on the country. So the bubble is not in one asset, it's in all domestic assets. And the way that the bubble appears is just that the exchange rate appreciates. And then you say, if I fight the bubble, increase in interest rate, I will create more capital inflows, and I may make even worse the problem of the bubble. This is, I think, that is a big problem. You can do in that case, and I think that if you want really to burst the bubble, you can do intervention, you can do things on a transitory basis, because bubbles are very vulnerable too. So my impression is today, we don't have a problem for bubble. We have a real problem, which is high terms of trade, strong economies, and I have one rule of thumb for currencies. And the rule of thumb said strong countries, strong currencies. And that's what emerging markets are, quote-unquote, suffering. The strength of emerging markets is good returns. What we see is that there will be difference in interest or whatever. No, there are differences in returns because it's much more profitable to invest in an emerging market than in a developed country. So this is the real problem. So I wouldn't argue that we are going to revolve except those that we create because of mistakes or mismanagement of macro policy. So now I'll show here Dutch disease. Let me make a couple of comments on Dutch disease. I want to go to the last point. It's really a disease. I always say when I go to Congress, I say, we are going through it. Enfermedad holandesa, they said in Chile. Syndrome holandesa. I would say, I would like this country to be like Holland. So it's to be Dutch. So there is a problem. The Dutch disease, and you go with the details about this, was in the 60s and discovery of oil. But at the end, countries adjust and they have high income, they live pretty well, and so I would really like to have that disease. There are much worse diseases. Now, there are tensions, and this is why it's a disease. I think the disease is two things, because of terms of trade are high or because you discover a natural resource. It doesn't matter whether it's a value of a quantity, it's the same. I find a bit blurred this discussion about this is capital inflows or no, this is a natural resource boom. The country becomes richer. This may bring capital inflows, may not bring capital inflows. In Chile, there are no capital inflows because we know all copper, but copper is going up and up and up, and it's the same. It's like discovering a new mine, okay, but because prices are quite high. So the underlying idea is that the commodity boom leads to an appreciation because of many factors, hurts the manufacturing sectors, and this may be detrimental for the country. We have to tell story that the industrial sector provides some externality that the natural resource sector or even the service sector, okay, let's see, the IT sector has no externality. So the externality here is in building, I don't know, industry, cars or whatever, TVs and whatever. I'm not so sure. And the evidence roughly shows that countries go through increasing commodity prices. They can adjust. Chile has had a huge commodity boom, but we have had also record growth in employment, very strong growth. So I don't see, there are tensions and there are a lot of tensions because of exchange rate adjustment, but I wouldn't put it as a problem of the Dutch disease. There is a long-term discussion. I will not go about that. And it's, they are a curse or a blessing. And there is all this discussion why Africa, which is so rich in natural resources, is so poor. And I think that something has to be with a rent-seeking society. I won't go that. And institutions and human capital. So, but I'm talking about Latin America, middle-income countries. So let me go to my last point, which is tackling capital flows and exchange rate appreciation. What we see in the world is that no figures yet. That's a couple. What we see in the world, first, large interest rate differentials. Why? Because the U.S. won't raise rates for a while. We have inflation, and we need to raise rates. So that's very simple. However, I didn't bring that figure because interest rate differential are not so huge today compared to the last 10 years. Interest rate differential are 4-5 percentage points among emerging markets and developed countries, and they are not that high. There is dispersion across countries, but overall there is not a huge. They were much bigger in the early 90s when there were really a problem of capital inflows. When Calvo, Reinhardt, and Lederman wrote the early 90s paper on the capital inflows problem, really there were capital inflows coming to emerging market, large financing, large current account deficit, and creating vulnerabilities. Today, emerging markets have a current account surplus on average, and most emerging markets have current account surpluses. So on the net, we're lending to the world. The world is not lending to us to sustain a consumption boom. So there are differences in returns, and there are capital inflows. Now, the issue here, which especially with this discussion of macroprudential, what's the objective or what's the purpose of macro policy? So is exchange rate stability? So is, as the paper said in a way, let's try to avoid volatility. is that we worry about the level of the exchange rate, as Piero said, or is financial vulnerabilities? And I think that the three are mixed, and we have to be very clear. It could be the three of them, okay? But let me tell you, regarding exchange rate stability, I think that much more important than trying to stabilize with the government, that sometimes is very successful, especially when markets are very deep, okay, is that you have to create a forward market. We said this like 10 years ago, 15 years ago in Chile, and the forward market has really, really deepened. You see now, first was for big firms, now small, and not small, but medium-sized enterprise, they all have 12-month insurance for their current exposure. So there is a deep market that can protect and hedge against stability. And the way to incentive the creation of this market is to have a well-working financial system, but at the same time to have some volatility to hedge. Because if the government is the one that is in charge of doing the stability, there is no incentives for the private provision of insurance. Second is the level. And I think that we have to recognize we worry about the level. We worry about the level because of the transition, because if there is a lot of pressures, there are costs in the transition and the reallocation of resources. Now, it's not that we have an objective of a level, which is what markets would like to know, what your objective, what your level. No, you worry when there is a sharp appreciation, because and then you can do things. And that's what, in Chile, what we do is intervention. Now, we have done it twice in Chile, intervention. And I'll go immediately and show you. I think that this is the best. This is very interesting. Well, I hope. It's the first one. This is the intervention 08 in intervention 011. We intervene in April 08. We intervene in April 11. The intervention is almost the same. 08, 8 billion. 11, it was not 11 billion, 12 billion. It's a bit bigger. And we said we will accumulate reserves to have a level that we think that is adequate. We do it 50 million a day in an auction at midday. And fully sterilized. I didn't bring the other part. The rates, now they have been more stable than before. But the exchange rate, in 08, it went up even in the first 2 months, 20%. Then it appreciated and then kept going up because this was when the world was exploding, okay? In contrast, now it has been extremely stable. Overall, our estimations is that effectiveness is limited. If we take only the 08 experiment, you will say, okay, we put a dummy for when we start intervening and you see that the thing explodes. But there are many differences. I'll show you two differences. Here is the longest story of the Chilean exchange rate, the blue line. The red line is the multilateral dollar. So what's happened in 08, that when we start intervening, the dollar start strengthening. And why start strengthening? Because after Bernstein, there was a reduction of risk appetite and the dollar strengthened. So part of the appreciation that we see in 08 was that the dollar, you see the correlation between the green line coming down and the blue line going up. So this is very, now the dollar has remained at the weakest level of very long time. What happened? This is just to summarize. In 08, after we start intervening, copper start coming down. Now, copper still is at the highest level, and with respect to December, futures have gone up. So there are a strong debate. It's very difficult, so the effectiveness is limited. We do it in a sterilized, very mechanical, because we want to keep full control on monetary policy. So it's effectiveness is limited. We have computed our regressions, said that size, which is quite sizable, is about 4% of GDP. It may have 3-5% effects on the exchange rate. So let me go to the most puzzling issue, which is capital controls. It's very ironic because Chile is the poster child for capital controls, and Chileans are the most skeptical on capital controls, I wrote papers trying to find effects for capital control, and I didn't find that many effects, although Eduardo will say that we found it in the interest rate and many things, But at the end, what we want to do with capital controls is exchange rate. It's not interest rate. So at the end, the final test is whether capital controls avoid or prevent appreciation in countries. What do you do with the interest rate, with whatever? That's secondary, I think. I think that the purpose, everybody said, we don't want hot capital. Why? Because we want to have monetary power. No, because this will appreciate our currency, will affect our exporters and export-led growth. So that's the final test. So let me go to Chile. And let me tell you here, if you can. So there is a, before I go to these details, there is a discussion about, and we found in a paper, some effects on composition of flows. It tilts flows from short-term to long-term, of course, because you punish more short-term. Now, the issue is where you can do that straight with financial regulation. You just change provisions to whatever, just a rule and a mandate to banks, you know, about exposition to short-term. So it's not needed to do huge capital control. Now, in the paper, what we did was to compute that was a significant effect, but the economic effect, the magnitude, was quite small. Second, I'm very confused because we say this and there are effects of interest rate. It creates some difference. I have come with one doubt more recently, and it's about causality. It's not causality. Whether countries that have a high interest rate, they find a lot of pressures on capital inflows, so then they create the capital controls come after. So basically, what we see and what we compute is to say, well, capital controls are differential interest rate, but there is no causality, there is no discussion what leads to what. Indeed, Chile started applying in the early 90s the capital controls, but with real interest rate close to wherever you take, a 5% paper at 8%. So quite large interest rate, okay? So what we have much more normal interest rate in the 2000s. That's why we don't see now, we're not flooding of capital inflows. If you go and see the figures for Chile, most of the inflows are corporations that are borrowing abroad because there are good conditions and they come. So this is most of the inflows, but there are no people, many funds to come to. There are some, I think, and as interest rate goes up, probably there may be more, but it's not a huge inflow. This is the difference in interest rate. Okay, so this is the period of capital inflows. It's of a huge difference between interest rate, domestic and foreign interest rate. We're talking about peak of 6% in some periods. So that's a real differential. We don't talk much milder, very close to zero in the future when you adjust. And this is exposed inflation. This is just to illustrate that there is an issue about large, very substantial interest rate that we don't know whether they came before or whether they were the cause of the capital, the capital inflows, and then the introduction of capital controls. So, and this may happen in some other countries recently. So, then just before going to the last figure, just one final point. Capital controls have distortions, and accumulation of reserve have cost. Capital controls have distortions. First, they create discrimination because those who have access to foreign financing can finance themselves. A small and medium enterprise, they tend not to have the access to foreign financing. So this is discrimination. Then you move from the regulated part to the unregulated because, in general, capital controls are the following form. Say, no speculation, just productive capital. It's a very blur definition, okay? But you say, we don't want speculators. We just want people that comes to build mines. So miners, they come, no capital controls, and the no miners, we don't want you. This is not the miners. This is just a story to tell the story. So miners will come and will say, okay, I go to your country because good copper price. I want to invest in your country. I want to build a mine. And I want to enter to your country $5 billion, just in case, because the mine costs one. So who's doing the arbitrage? The miner, the CFO. So there is a lot of loopholes and problems. So and then we start moving to unregulated. I think that if one wants to do it, just go plain and let's avoid this discussion. Countries, go abroad and say, come to my country if you are productive, not if you are speculators. I have a lot of problems to understand that. So this is the last figure. It's the real exchange rate. This is the real exchange rate. In the 2000s, we have had floating, a lot of volatility. We have had floating, some intervention at the peak here in 102, and then intervention here and here. Okay, some intervention, partial effects. But if we look at this figure, what's the lowest, most appreciated exchange rate? Here. What happened here? We had low copper price. I think that was 150. So it was low copper price. The economy is not like today that we have a lot of net foreign assets. We're a very rich economy. We were not that rich. We have capital controls. We accumulate reserves. And we have an exchange rate ban. So I don't need too much regressions to say that it's very disputable. And there's another, and this is my final comment about capital controls and the way to impose capital control. Contrary to when would you do something very rule-based, and this is that capital controls, I have heard, and many policymakers said, we just will apply capital controls to smooth the appreciation, not to avoid it. Of course, what's the message for investors? Let's go now that cheap. Because in the future, we will exceed expenses. So we exacerbate capital inflows and pressures of the currency. Basically, because unless that you have something rule-based, very well-defined, and very stable, like what we do with exchange rate intervention. So those were my remarks about that.
Thank you, Jose. Let's move on now directly to our last speaker. We're already past the time, so I'm going to be brief. But I have to be. But I have also to say, very specially, that I'm particularly happy to be hosting today a very good friend, a very admired economist, and a remarkable minister. It's always good to host. Friends, but when they come with those other qualities, is an even more fulfilling experience. Juan Carlos Echeverry has been Minister of Finance in Colombia since August of last year. Prior to that, he had a long career, Minister of Planning in the past, Dean of the School of Economics at the Universidad de Los Andes, and a very well-respected economist and commentator in our homeland, Colombia. He's doing a tremendous job. Yesterday, he probably is going to talk about that, but one of the big challenges that he has is to change the way Colombia hands royalties from natural resources, especially mining and oil. And it's a very difficult process, but in the end, it is a process about fiscal sustainability, it's about saving, it's about all the important things we'll be talking about today. And if it was not because of his leadership, all these reforms would not be taking place. So, Juan Carlos, it's always a pleasure, and it's a great honor to have you close this panel.
Thank you, Mauricio. Muchas gracias. I will have comments on Latin America based on what I've heard. I've made some comments, and then I will focus on Colombia. That a recent taxonomy from the IDB, which separates the, let's say, Mexican-type Latin American countries from the Brazilian type. I think it's not precise, but it's helpful. And there's, of course, the other taxonomy, which is the market-friendly vis-à-vis the not-so-market-friendly. So we could make a quadrant and put the Mexican-type market and non-market-friendly and the Brazilian type. And that helps mapping what could happen in the future. Because in the past, what the puzzle for Latin America is, wherever you are in that quadrant, you have done well. Market-friendly or not, you did very well. and Mexican type or Brazilian type, you have done well. What's the difference between the Mexican type and the Brazilian type is more dependent on the U.S. and more or less zero, but let's say Mexican types are more dependent on the U.S. and the Brazilian types are more South dependent, more China and South-South type of growth, type of trade. But the puzzle then is we all did very well during the Great Recession and during this decade. Of course, the explanation, I think it's clear for all of us, in terms of trade hike for during the last 10 years, or whatever you did, rightly or wrongly, micro and macro, was not punished because it was rewarded that we were all sitting on a pile of enormous wealth. So, and this wealth is paying very well. So, apart from your micro and macro management, we all did well. Of course, capital flows helped, and that is the situation right now. So, what comes in the future for the region? I would say that this taxonomy would help, because I'm seeing, let's say, at least five types of challenges for the next 2 years, 2 or 3 years. Maybe the unraveling of the U.S. and Europe stances in monetary policy and fiscal policy will be affecting all of us. And that's what worries me the most. When I heard in the last meetings in October, Secretary of the Treasury, Gaynor, telling us, the Minister of Finance, about QE2 in the plane coming back to Colombia, I thought we have to defend ourselves with everything we have against this thing, which is, because it's transitory, is substantial. It will have very predictable effects on bubbles, and there's no way we have to pay a cost for what's happening in the U.S. So, but the U.S. policy and the European policy, monetary and fiscal policies in the next 2 years or 3 years pose a big threat for us. I talked to economists, and nobody seems to worry. The economist presents a very rosy scenario for the U.S., and Europe is improving, and the IMF report, and everybody seems to be very optimistic about this. But what I learned in my studies was that you can, unsustainable policies at some point show up their unsustainability. So maybe you can have this in advanced countries for longer periods, but coming from Latin America, if you pile up reasons for unraveling, at some point that comes. So as finance minister, that's the thing that in the short term worries me. In the medium term, from let's say 2014 to 2020, the other unraveling I'm seeing is this China and India. When you look at the picture 320 from your report of many other reflections, is how China and India can grow, let's say, and you were saying, probably not at 10% during another decade, but maybe at 5 or 6, which is great, but then prices of commodities will come down, right, secularly, and then we have to prepare for that. And the reaction of Latin American countries then will be different between who are Mexican type and Brazilian type, and who are market-friendly and non-market-friendly. I think that the key issues are, how can you manage terms of trade unraveling in the long term, let's say post-2013? And that would be the negative part. But the positive part also is there will be the return of some manufacturing. The Dutch disease that you are identifying, and this reflection for me started a couple of weeks ago. I got this visit from a manufacturing of apparel in Cali, which is an industrial city, but not the most industrialized city in Colombia. And she told me that the orders from the U.S. were peaking at a record high. And she said, everything we produce we're selling to the U.S. and we keep more orders and orders. We keep getting more. Say why? And she's not a macroeconomist. She's a businesswoman. She said it's because labor prices, labor costs in Asia, and especially in China, now are very close to ours. I said, wow, this is a completely different ballgame. If, let's say, not immediately, but in the next 5 years, the costs of labor in China and India will start approaching, I don't know, not the differential we have seen in the last 20 years, 30 years, but let's say 10 to 20% differences. Well, we can be back in the industrializing business. We have been out of this business in the 60s because the East Asian and then China and in India came out in the last 40 years. But we will be out of this business in the next 30 years or 20 years. Well, that's a good question. I don't know, but I see the first signs of the possibilities that the countries that have potential in manufacturing, of course, Brazil, and I see Colombia in that, the Brazilian type, market friendly, I see very good possibilities that we can manage the terms of unraveling, which has positive sides, has negative sides, we all know them, but also has positive sides, and the return from manufacturing. The third challenge for me is avoiding bubbles. Jose Luis said, and we all know, monetary policy and credit policy for me are the key issues in doing that. And fortunately, we have good central bankers. We have anticipation in monetary policy, and we proved that in the last 5 years. I think most of Latin Americans, I think, are doing very well in this. The other thing is finding sources of growth. I will go to this issue in a second. And the other thing is fiscal flexibility. With these general comments on how I see our recent past and our upcoming future for this decade, very broadly, let me go then to Colombia's story. Because then, if I don't do that, I won't be doing my business, which is promoting Colombia and telling you what is our story. So, how does Colombia fit in this broader picture, and what are we doing? First, in the recent past, Colombia came from agriculture to mining in the 80s and 90s. Came from macro threats like to security, all the cocaine-related guerrillas, etc., to stability, to security. Let's say that has been done in 70%. It's not already fully done. And also the shift from agribusiness to oil and mining is like 60% of that shock in the last 30 years. And from fiscal instability to, I think, sustainability. What is happening in the immediate future? I have discovered the last 8 months I have been Minister of Finance. I have my epiphany has been that everything is final, is fiscal, or almost everything is fiscal. If you do the fiscal front right, your monetary policy is much easier. If you do the fiscal policy right, your exchange rate policy is much easier. So basically, macro is mostly fiscal, but fiscal is mostly micro, which is well, how do you manage that? Because fiscal is you have to go to Congress and affect rents here and rents there, and is micro. So you have to go, if you get the fiscal right, you get the macro right. But for doing it well, you have to have a very solid micro story, an economic and political economy story. So what are we doing? We just did a reform in taxes, a healthcare reform, and employment reform, all of them already approved, which are okay, and I don't need more revenues in this model. I need is more micro. In the micro, we're doing a constitutional reform, changing transferences, creating a sovereign wealth fund. But for us, it's interesting because it is a sovereign wealth fund of the regions, not of the central government. And it will be a substantial fund. It has been already approved in 5 out of 8 debates. I just approved the 5th debate on Wednesday. And it went basically without opposition. At the beginning, there was opposition. But recently, we have, I could tell you the whole story, but basically political economy helped a lot, and we are doing an amazing job, I think, in creating savings, not in the central government now, but in the subnational governments. We're passing a fiscal rule, which will do the same for the central government, and of course, the regions are asking me, well, we're going to save $1.5 billion per year. What's the central government going to do? So we're paying our share in passing a fiscal rule. And we're passing a fiscal sustainability constitutional reform. This is interesting. Apparently only Germany has fiscal sustainability in its constitution, which is very philosophical, but there the debate has been hectic. The difference between center-right and center-left has come to the fore, and the debate. I'm center-right, and if you ask people in Colombia, I'm right from the center-right. But it is very interesting. I think we just approved the fifth debate of that out of eight as well. And we will introduce fiscal sustainability in the constitution, which is interesting because our constitutional court is very active. Well, Congress is Congress everywhere. And also, central government is complicated. So they say, if we have been doing well fiscally, why do you need that? I say, well, maybe I know Greeks would have liked to have that in their constitution. So you don't do this for ministers that like fiscal austerity. You have these provisions for ministers who are very austere. So that reform is interesting. I just stopped there, for a while. But let's say basically, with this we would. And we have still pending a good tax reform, because the one we did was just for revenues, but now we have to do one for the microstructure. But with this, we want to stress the two words, or the one word, which is crucial for the future, which is savings. Especially in this part with terms of trade, positive terms of trade shocks, and everything going well, and growth going well, you have to save. If you do that, that's basically the mantra for fiscal policy. And that's what our president already has not only bought this agenda, but internalized it in order to avoid commodity price linked mergers, okay? And to do misaccounting our actual wealth. So in the fiscal front, basically, that's the agenda. We have done mostly of all of the homework right now. In exchange rate, in October, President Santos called me and said, look, when I wake up, I think in the Bacrim, which are some criminal bandas criminales, which are nasty in Colombia, and in exchange, and I think of the exchange rate. And I thought, I'm going
to... the central bank.
Not to me. And then I thought, I'm done, because, well, soon after that, the military killed Mono Jojoy, which was like the bad, bad guy. And then I said, well, I don't have Mono Jojoy. I don't know how to devalue the exchange rate. And then I said, but actually, that's true. I don't know how to do it. And we economists don't know how to do that. I mean, I haven't come to IMA for 26 years. Now, in my professional life, and we economists, we like to talk about the exchange rate, we do regressions, but we don't know that much about how to manage the exchange rate. So I called what I call the pirates, which is people in the market who actually have been attacking the dollar. And I appointed one of them, the head of public credit, another one, which is a woman who was one of the best traders, my advisor. And on the other side of the table, the two or three people who have been in charge of controlling, let's say, capital inflows and the exchange rate the last 15 years. So I say, yeah, we have on the left-hand side, we have the creators of all distortions. And on the right-hand side, we have the people who have avoided and circumvented all their distortions. So please tell me what to do. And we were working for 2 weeks. And we came out with, we tried to avoid, and we still try to avoid, for the reasons you mentioned, actually, capital controls. And we came out with chirurgic measures, but basically the truth was easy. This is basically fiscal. We did chirurgic things here and there, nice, and they were effective. For instance, there was a withholding tax on interest paid for domestic borrowing, but there was not for foreign borrowing. So there was a tributary incentive to borrow. So we imposed which is the one you have here in your report, our withholding tax. But basically, it was stop bringing dollars, after those sessions, I just said we'll keep Ecopetrol's dividends in abroad in the U.S., which were at that time $1.5 billion, because I had the revenues, the fiscal revenues, I could do that. So at that moment, the exchange rate started devaluing, and it devalued like 5% in the next two or three months. My wife, who's a very good economist, doesn't believe there is that. She says it's just luck. There was China, Portugal, etc. No, I don't buy that story. But that's my story. And I still believe that at least half of that devaluation was because of our policies. But basically, I still think that the very conservative type of intervention of the Colombian Central Bank or of the Chilean Central Bank is the right way to go. We buy $20 million per day in a very pre-announced fashion. But if you don't pair that with a very strong fiscal scenario and equilibrium, that doesn't work. I mean, it's basically fiscal, and the same for monetary policy. So I opt for working with practitioners who know every day, because every 2 weeks there's something new in the exchange rate market. So I call this guy, what's going on? What's the news today? And these guys tell me we shouldn't react to this. It will pass in the next, two or 3 weeks because it's this and this and that. And to other types of things, they say we should start to think about how to react. And I think that my take here, Andres Velasco told me before I started my tenure as minister, told me never stop intervening verbally. So you have to stay in the microphones almost every day saying, I know interest rate, exchange rate matter. I'm working on it. I will keep working on it. Maintaining the Minister of Finance, sending the market the message that you're going to be there and you have the people and that you already were successful somehow, and you that's very important. If you, I mean, in Colombia in the last four or five years, the ministers and we, our colleagues, the economists, we always say there will be appreciation, there's nothing to do, and there's nothing that helps more. No speculation in favor of the peso. That saying, no, that you are done. So I keep that advice by Andres Velasco. He told me I wish I would have done more. So I can hardly do more. I am in the microphones very often saying I will be there, but I keep my practitioners working there. In asset bubbles, probably I'm relying on what we can do with the central bank in interest rate and credit policies. And basically, in the more distant future, I think the crucial issue is about the sources of growth and which distortions you can remove from the economy in its existing shape. So in Colombia, I think we have a story, and with this I finish. We have a story based on the bottlenecks of the economy for this decade, removing these bottlenecks. The first bottleneck is, of course, finishing the security issue. The second is infrastructure. The third is agribusiness. Colombia is the only big country of Latin America that has not had an agricultural revolution because of the war, of course, the internal conflict. So we have an amazing possibility in our countryside for having another boom that could last 10 years, let's say what Chile did 25 years ago, and Argentina, and Brazil, and Peru, and Mexico, we can do in the next 10 years. Financial deepening as well, and formalization, and things in education and innovation. If you focus on the current, on these issues, and we can solve them, and there's a lot of homework to do there, I think Colombia has, I do think, as Piero said, that this could be the decade of Colombia, because we have many distortions that we remove them, and things that problems in the concession system for infrastructure, etc., in the agribusiness. If we do what our peers in Latin America have done in the last 25 years in these sectors I just mentioned, which is the ones we call the locomotives of growth, right? Our locomotoras. I think Colombia this decade can be a decade of growth between 5 and 7, let's say average, let's say around 6% of growth. We don't aim for anything like that because of sustainable growth. So I think that the story for Colombia is very positive, but my conclusion would be, in the short term, your macro issue is the crucial thing, and in the long term, your growth story is the crucial thing. So we try to get both things right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We do have time for two questions. I think it would be unfair with these very prominent speakers not to say anything. So if if any of you have a, is there a, yeah, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Wang Yu, financial reporter from Chinese magazine, which Caijing magazine, which is a business economics magazine. And my question would be, so in the financial recovery session, different countries in different positions, especially China and Australia, we have already increased our co-interest rate for several times, but the States still has the losing monetary policy. So what would be the impact towards the Latin America, and what your government is going to do? Thanks.
Thank you. Anyone else wants to jump in? Yes?
Hi, my question is, why when you intervene, emphasize the fact that the amount that you are going to intervene each time, in contrast of not saying anything to the market?
All right. Anyone else? Yes, last.
Hi, I'm Patrice Robitaille. I'm from the Federal Reserve, but...
Can you speak up a little bit?
Hi, I'm from Patrice Robitaille. I'm from the Federal Reserve, but I'm not in the domestic division, so I don't know. Don't ask me about monetary policy. But the question for Jose de Gregorio was concerning the graph that had the interest rate differentials, which I thought was interesting, but I couldn't see the scale. So those look like ex post interest rates, and they're not adjusted for risk premiums, and I don't know if you've tried doing that. I'm sure they'd be much smaller because the inflation risk premium would have been pretty large in Chile in the early 1990s, I would imagine. So
let me ask Juan Carlos Echeverri. I really like what you said about the amount of optimal criticism that one needs at home. I think that's a very good point, and I'll always to be a little bit agnostic and skeptical about these things. You did not mention in your presentation the recent upgrading in Colombia's rating and the fact that Colombia is now investment grade, and what could these mean from the point of view of precisely the topics we're talking in the short run in terms of the exchange rate pressures, et cetera. So do you foresee that in the short run we're going to have to deal with a situation that is harder than what you had to deal in the first 7 months. So in other words, do you foresee that you have to change the team and bring now the guys that are making the money, that know how, which are the loop side and in the legislation? I don't know which one of you wants to take the question on China.
Yeah, repeat. China, it's not China, Australia, Chile too, many countries are increasing interest rate and the U.S. still have a low interest rate. But that's what I said in my presentation. I think it's important is the difference are not a huge magnitude. Of course, and part of the monetary transmission mechanism is not that affect only the cost of credit, it also affect the exchange rate. But the magnitudes are not thinking that we really have a huge appreciation of the currency. The magnitudes are under control. And if they are not under control, you can do things, and you can do, for example, exchange rate intervention regarding to your question. You asked me why you announce exactly 50 million a day. Even at the beginning, we set the time. Now we change the time in the morning because sometimes it was kind of too excessive rule-based, so we change it. Why? Because how intervention affects the exchange rate. So I think that there are two stories about intervention. Two stories. One is that the large amount basically changed the relative stocks of domestic currency and foreign currency available. So what you are doing is just by buying the stock of dollar, changing the relative value of the dollar with the peso. It's a supply demand, let's say. You need to tell some story about imperfect substitution and some theory, because otherwise, in general, in theory, sterilized intervention is ineffective. In a well-functioning, perfect financial market, it's very easy to say today that financial markets are not perfect. So it's but then the other story is that you do noise and you start affecting the risk premium.
But affecting the risk premium is too tiny. It's too tiny, like saying, to say, you can change this risk premium 50 basis point, 100 basis point, but that's a 2-3 month of monetary policy. So it's really minor. So first of all, just playing around during the day, I don't think that's too effective. Second, you give a very bad signal, and it's that you worry because the day that you start selling and buying, you are indicating some objective for exchange rate. And that contaminates your decision of monetary policy. So if you want to really be able to run monetary policy independently, you have to have a very rule-based intervention. We even announced the program of sterilization. Everything is fully announced. We can suspend it. We can do some change if things change. But in general, we much prefer the rule-based because, first, there's no difference in effectiveness in terms of affecting the exchange rate, and second, because it provides monetary policy independence. And the second question, and the final question, was regarding this is a table that I asked yesterday night because I said I will show this. If you correct by risk premium, there are some difference, but if you correct by exposed changes in the exchange rate, was much higher the differential, because the exchange rate in Chile, the peso was strengthening very sharply. So you have to add like 3-4 percentage point a year.
Since we have the same announced intervention, I will also comment on the issue of why this 20 million every day, very boring type of intervention. First, because it works. It had worked 3 times in the last 8 years, and then the central bank was very eloquent in saying, this type of thing works, but basically because speculators are not that smart and that complicated and that sophisticated. If you are bringing this amount of dollars as government and Ecopetrol, the state, the oil state-owned company, is also bringing the dollars, so it's clearly, the signal is absolutely clear, and then the speculators will go with you. You're just filling up the swimming pool, so they are jumping and this. So there are two ways to empty the pool, which is, one is the government saying, I'm going to keep this money abroad, but this is fiscal, and that's one. And the other one is, besides that, it works a lot if the central bank says, and every day I will keep also extracting and drying up the money. That works only for us, I don't know in Chile, but that works only if we have also the macroprudential policies that are crucial. I didn't mention that is critical. Nicolás Izaguirre came in October advocating capital controls in Colombia, and he had like 17 measures. Out of that, we have already 15 in place. No, that Koreans found something very 1 year ago. We have that in place since 5 years ago. Problem with Colombia is that we don't write the papers, but the instruments are there from a long time ago. So if you have the macroprudential regulations for your financial system, so only the real sector is the one that is speculating. And we track almost every company in Colombia, and the speculators are the real sector. But on the real sector, if you send a signal from the fiscal front and the central bank front in the same direction, you are effective. So it's not, I only if you have this framework, very strong macroprudential policies in your financial sectors. Otherwise, the size of intervention becomes humongous and very complicated. And you have the fiscal front also fixed. You can, your very, very announced and pre-announced and boring type of intervention the central bank works. I don't think that in a vacuum that works, of course. And finally, about the Standard & Poor's, we expect to have investment grade also by Moody's and by Fitch during this year at some point. And of course, that's complicating things. But what I say about the exchange rate is that we are not going to fight against the trend appreciation. We're fighting against this bubble, appreciation that is happening. But we don't fight the trend appreciation. And the improvement in the ratings are trend deep things. So I will not fight against those things. I welcome them, and their effect on the exchange rate will be shown, and our entrepreneurs will have to live with that.
All right. Well, thank you very much. It's been a great session. I think one thing you can know about this region is that these two gentlemen here pass the Arminio Fragas test. And the Arminio Fragas test is that since we don't have a textbook that really tells us what to do, we have to go with a simple rule, which is the blush test, which is you do things that don't make you look blush when you announce them. These gentlemen will never do things that are things that the markets could consider detrimental, but they're pragmatic, and that pragmatism, I think, is very much in order in a region that has tremendous challenges and has to really manage the current conditions before it can actually say that it has accomplished what we all want, which is the long-lasting growth that will make this the decade of the region. So that pragmatism is always very handy and very valuable when it comes with good analysis. So thank you for coming, and thank you for sharing with us your thoughts about the challenge.